This is Bhagavatam, we're studying, we're going to do this. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Chapter of the second canto, Purusha Sutta confirmed. This means that the contents of this chapter is confirmed by the famous Purusha Sutta Stutis of the Rig Veda. You know the Purusha Sutta prayers? Anybody can chant it? All the guys who train up in the group was here, they do it all the time. You know, do you know what Purusha Sutta? Describes that person with 1,000 heads and 1,000 arms. Basically, the Virat Rupa. So I'm assuming, when I teach this, that everybody has read the text, because we move right along. We are covering in a couple of weeks. We're covering 5 chapters, so we have this is a fast ride. It's like touring Europe by airplane. You look down as you go over. We don't get to we'll make a few brief stops, but we really have to move along. So here, this chapter is actually a continuation of the previous one, because in the previous chapter, for the second time in the second canto, the universal form is being described. You notice in the Bhagavatam that the universal form is described 3 times. It's mentioned a number of times, but actually for a multi-verse description. The first is second canto, first chapter, called The First Step in God Realization, where you studied that, focused the mind on the gross potencies of the Lord, and in this way gradually ascend to an understanding of the Supersoul, which is then the next chapter, Lord in the Heart. So now we come again to the universal form. And then in the third canto, in the sixth chapter, there's also the universal form, where the creation of the universal form is described. This is a kind of cosmic embryology. Because the idea of the universal form is that the universe is a living being. And this is one of the major points of studying the universal form is to understand that the universe is not only a living being, but is the form of the Lord, a form of the Lord. And that should change our relationship to the universe. In other words, a little respect. More than a little respect. We should look at it. If the universal form is being described again, how does this differ from the first description? Because there's a pedagogical method that Krishna uses that's found in the Bhagavad Gita, which is not linear, but kind of circular. A topic is raised, discussed, other topics, and then you go back around, you hit it again, and this time from another angle of vision or with a certain aspect, kind of more details and more richness is added and it fills in, and then you go on to other, and you come back around again. So it's not like the kind of outline that you're taught to do in college, you know, for presenting a talk. But it's a different system. So here again, we see the same thing. We come back to the universal form. But here we have a little more analytical detail is added. Because in the previous chapter, I think in the previous chapter, there was introduced this way of looking at the world in terms of Dravya Shakti, Kriya Shakti, and Jnana Shakti. You remember this? I wasn't there to teach it, so I hope you know this. Which Prabhupada describes as the Adibhautic manifestations, Adidaivika and Adiatmika. That is to say, with reference to what's in the world as the material elements, Adibhautic. Adidaivik, the controlling system, the demigods and so on. Nadiatmik, the conditioned living entity with his various senses and mind and so on. So now with this universal form, you see what's described, when the universal form is described, the senses are mentioned. Like, for example, the mouth of the Virat-Purusha. We were looking at the very first, I'll turn this on. How do you turn it on again? Do you have the mic again? Yeah. Am I covering some of this?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, here's the... You see, the mouth. So the mouth is one of the... part of the indriyas, the senses. One of the potencies of the vajra. And the controlling deity is mentioned. Right? Here it is fire, Agni. Also what's mentioned are the Vishaya, the senses, or rather the sense objects, the Indriya, the senses, Vishaya, the sense objects, Indriyarta, the objects of the senses. You see later on different food stuffs and things like that, because the tongue is mentioned. The controlling deity, the material substance, like fire is also a material substance, and water and so on. And then the place from the universal form from which this originated. So in the material world, there's the place, the mouth of the Virat Purusha, then that's where it's this place of origin. Then we have the voice, the speech, the controlling deity, and that's all it mentions here, but other places, the skin is mentioned here, which generates the Vedic hymns, the skin of the universal form. Vedic hymns are what you speak. Then the tongue, which is tasting, produces edibles and things like that. So you'll see all through this is the so things are described. Not they don't always mention everything with every one of them, but these are basically these five things are discussed in terms of the universal form. The senses, the sense objects, the material substance, the controlling deities, and where they originate in the universal form. And this much more detailed and analytical than the first description. Okay. So, any questions about that? So you'll see there. So in the beginning, Prabhupada has a long purport. And typically this purport is more about than just this verse, but about the whole idea of the universal form and why we study or look at the universal form. And it is a way of relating everything to the Lord. And Prabhupada derives a lesson from this, as we'll see here. If I get a little pointer here. The material voice or the energy of taking the pusa is generated originally from the Lord. Before that, since the generating center of the different parts are of the universal form of the Lord, and since the form of the Lord is transcendental to the material creation, it is to be understood that the voice, the tongue, the skin, and so on, suggests that the Lord in his transcendental form is not without them. This is a continuing point that Prabhupada makes. And in a way, what Prabhupada is doing implicitly and sometimes explicitly is counteracting an impersonalist account of the universal form. Because the impersonalists tend to believe that the highest form of the Lord as a supreme person is the universal form. They say that avidya or ignorance has two aspects, collective and individual. And just like when there's a forest, there's a tree, and then there's the forest, which is all the trees together. So when avidya is viewed or seen individually, it's called the jivatma. And when it's viewed collectively, it's called God. And that collective thing is the universal form. So when the impersonalists read the Bhagavad Gita, they think the ultimate revelation of God is the universal form. And that's why Prabhupada goes out of his way in his purport in the Bhagavad Gita to describe the universal form as a godless, notice that word, a godless display of opulences. Because Arjuna's relationship with Krishna is broken by dealing with the universal form. And what people don't seem to notice is he finally says to the Lord, kindly show me your personal two-handed form again. I want to see that, that with which he has a relationship. So everywhere Prabhupada is using this to understand the universal form. Everything comes from Krishna. Everything here below is a reflection of what is above. This is a very important principle everywhere. Prabhupada is even described, he says, we are small samples of God. And you can understand God by studying ourselves. We are persons, therefore God is a person. So here, the universal form is this, indicates the transcendental variegatedness of the Lord. We see varieties in this world. Where do they come from? Janmadasyataha. Everything comes from Brahman. If there are varieties here, then therefore there must be varieties there. By varieties, Prabhupada is translating the Sanskrit word Vishesha. Remember in Prabhupada's prana mantra, nirvishesha, shunyavadi? So the mayavadis are called nirvishesha. They deny concrete differences and concrete particulars. But we are savishesha. The Lord has these varieties. So you can see here in this purport, the material voice or the energy of taking in foodstuff is generated originally from the Lord. Such actions are but perverted reflections of the original reservoirs. A reservoir is that place where water is stored up and then distributed elsewhere. The transcendental situation is not without spiritual variegatedness. In the spiritual world, all the perverted forms of material variegatedness are fully represented in their original spiritual identity. This is a theme throughout this chapter. And he uses this word perverted. The word perverted, we have English words like convert, revert, pervert. Comes from a Latin root, this verb meaning to change or to turn, actually to turn. So pervert means turn from the right way, from the proper use, from truth into error, and so on. So it means misapplied or distorted in some way. So they are perverted reflections. They're reflections, but they are, we'll get into how they become distorted in this chapter. And Prabhupada starts this, and it becomes a theme later on here, in some of the last verses that we're going to go through the day. It's the difference. The only difference is that the material activities are contaminated. And now notice he's talking about activities. The universal form is active. We're all parts of that. Everyone is active. The senses mean for doing various things, either perceiving the world or acting back on the world. The living entities are action. The sense objects are there. We see from the account of creation that we get in the Bhagavatam that the whole creation is made for the sake of the living entities. It begins from contaminated consciousness. The consciousness of living entities viewed collectively, and then from that contaminated consciousness, all the different elements of creation evolve out. So it's made for the living entities to act, and to act how? Well, independently or separately from Krishna. So the only difference, that is, the difference between the original spiritual identity is that the material activities are contaminated by the three modes of material nature. And if you see, they all evolve out of false ego. There's a ahankara that shows up first, the very first thing, the ahankara. The false ego, I am the enjoyer, I am the controller. And then ahankara is divided into goodness, passion, and ignorance, and then from that everything else comes. So the three modes are there, appears in that ahankara. So that's material. Whereas the potencies in the spiritual world are pure. And why are they pure? Because they are engaged in the unalloyed transcendental loving service of the Lord. And now he explains that. How the activities of the spiritual world are different from those in the material world. So the implication here, as Prabhupada will draw out the implication, is that if the activities of the material world can be performed for the service of the Lord, they also become spiritual. And to that he quotes what the definition of bhakti is sarva upadhi nirmuktam tatparatena nirmalam rishikesha rishikesha sevanam bhakti uchite. One is purified, one is becoming liberated from all upadhis. Upadhis means material designation. Sarva upadhi nirmuktam. And purified by being nirmalam, by being dedicated to Krishna, then Rishikesha, Rishikena, Sevanam, the senses are engaged in the service of the master of the senses. That is what bhakti means. This is the definition actually from the Narada Pancharatra, quoted here in the Manjavula. But here Prabhupada says, originally, since this, all the senses are produced of the Lord's reservoir of senses. See, that's what we're seeing in this description. The sensual activities of the material world are to be purified by the process of devotional service, and thus the perfection of life can be attained simply by purifying the present position of our material activities. And Prabhupada goes on to describe this. Now, the place to look for this, I don't want to go back, but I'll just read it. In the Bhagavad Gita, this is something that everyone should see this, understand this text. 4.24, where sacrifice is described. Brahmarpanam, Brahmahavir, Brahmagna, Brahmanahutam, Brahmaiva, Inadantavya, Brahmakarma Samaya. This says, that this literally is describing a sacrifice, by which the various things in the sacrifice, the arpanam, the contribution, the butter, the havi, that's which is offered, the fire, the hutta, the goal, the activity, everything is Brahman. Everything in the sacrifice, everything becomes Brahman. Now, the way Prabhupada translates this is not literal. He translates it, a person who is fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, as Brahma Karma Samadhinam, is sure to attain the spiritual kingdom because of his full contribution to spiritual activities in which the consummation is absolute, and that which is offered is of the same spiritual nature. That's Prabhupada's translation. Because he's generalized a little bit from the particular ritual activity of a fire sacrifice to the general principle of working in such a way that everything becomes a sacrifice. And in its purport, Prabhupada describes, he says, this is the principle of Krishna consciousness is described here. And then he cites this idea that you're in the material world, you have material senses. These senses are the cause of bondage. But the same activity of the senses, used in the service of the Lord, become the cause of liberation. You have to act with the senses, but you change it. And he cites this homeopathic principle of medicine, that the same thing that caused the disease, used in a therapeutic way, can cure it. So Prabhupada says like this, the materially absorbed conditioned soul can be cured by Krishna consciousness as set forth here in the Gita. The process is generally known as yajna, or sacrifices simply for the satisfaction of Vishnu or Krishna. Now like I said, the more the activities of the material world are performed in Krishna consciousness or for Vishnu only, the more the atmosphere becomes spiritualized by complete absorption. This is Brahma Karma Samadhinam. The word Brahma, Brahman, means spiritual. The Lord is spiritual, and the rays of his transcendental body are called Brahma Jyoti, his spiritual effulgence. Everything that exists is situated in that Brahma Jyoti. But when the Jyoti is covered by illusion, Maya, or, what is the same thing, sense gratification, it is called material. So it's not, it's spirit, everything is Brahman. Saravam klavidam Brahman, it says in the Upanishads, everything is Brahman, and it's true. But when Brahman is covered by Maya, illusion, or sense gratification, it is called material. This material veil can be removed at once by Krishna consciousness. Thus, and now he translates the verse again, the offering for the sake of Krishna consciousness, the consuming agent of such an offering or contribution, the process of consumption, the contributor, and the results are all combined together of Brahman, or the Absolute Truth. The Absolute Truth covered by Maya is called matter.
So again, he comes back to this point. Matter, dovetailed for the cause of the absolute truth, regains its spiritual quality. Krishna consciousness is the process of converting the illusory consciousness into Brahman or the Supreme. So in other words, Krishna consciousness converts matter back into spirit. It's the re-spiritualization of matter. And that's what the universal form is, understanding the universal form is supposed to lead us to. It is not just a theory. There has to be action. When we understand the universal form, therefore understand everything as belonging to or relationship to Krishna, then the purport is that we must use it in Krishna's service. When we use it in Krishna's service, our senses, the sense objects, everything then regains its spiritual quality. So that's why even this, what's described as the one part of creation, one-fourth part of creation, of the Lord's creation is also the Lord's creation and is therefore one of his energies and therefore ultimately spiritual. So if you want to see Krishna everywhere, I want to see everything in Krishna, one has to engage everything in Krishna's service. Otherwise, it's just a mental idea. But if you want to have experience knowledge, this will come up later on, this idea of jnana and vijnana. Not just theoretical knowledge, but ascertained experience. Vijnana means science. That you perceive it directly. Just like later on, Brahma perceives the Lord directly. Just like today, you know, the claim of material science is we have confirmed it by experience. Well, there is an experience they are not able to have in their science because they don't go about it the proper way. But by going about the proper way, one can also have what's called in Bhagavatam Paresh Anubhava, that is say direct experience of the Lord, of the Supreme Lord. And that's always the point. That's what we're about. That's what our parampara is about. Direct experience of the Supreme. It's not just theoretical knowledge. It's supposed to transform us so that we become qualified to have these experiences of the Supreme. In all those different aspects. We have coming up, you know, scheduled incarnations with specific functions, so we get to know the Supreme Lord in so many different avatars. All these different features, all the different three kinds of super souls and features are there. Karanar Navashayi Vishnu, Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, Shirodakshayi Vishnu, these are all super soul features. All the different lila avatars, and this universal form is another one, another feature of the Lord. So this is what the point that Prabhupada is making here in this book purport also. The attachment of the material affinity may be simply changed to the service of the Lord. So as I said, this is a general discussion, not just on this particular verse, but all the verses in these descriptions of the absolute truth. So then we go on, and we come up to the describing as you can see, as we go through these verses, we'll see here that the universal forms and nostrils, nose holes, generate the prana. This power of smell, the Ashwini Kumar Demagach, who is the controlling deity, so that particular activity, yeah.
Just a question on the previous, you were talking about, you know, connecting...
Yeah, raise your hand any time, okay? Especially if you get tired of hearing my voice, you can interrupt.
Connecting everything back to, you know, its creative source and ultimately to the Lord, and then you're referring to the Vrindavanam. I'm just wondering if you could explain why one time we were catering this yoga group, you know, they were Mayavada yoga group, and before they would take prasad, but, you know, we cook the prasad and we offer the prasad, so then they'll line up and come and get their prasadam. So then they would all chant this verse, Brahmavana Brahmahavi Brahmavana Brahmavana, before their prasadam. So I'm just wondering, you know, I still to this day can't quite look out the connection of why that verse before they get
because that verse with that reiteration of Brahma, it says everything is one in Brahma. So they're just, you know, saying I am Brahman, this prasadam, this food is Brahman. But look, I mean, here's how these people work. In the early days of our movement, we used to have spiritual sky incense accounts. We used to sell them to our biggest customers were what were called hen shops, little stores that sold cigarette papers, pipes for smoking hashish, and so on, and other little things. They also liked incense. I mean, the owners of the head shops were drug dealers, and this is how they washed their money, laundered their money. They claimed they were doing so much business, but they liked incense because when people used to smoke marijuana to disguise it, they would burn incense. So spiritual sky incense became a big product for these people. It served a useful function. So we saw these head shops all the time. And sell them incense. So I was going to one such shop, and they said that they offered me ice cream. And those days we were very, very strict about not taking anything that's been first offered to Krishna. And I said, no, thank you. And the guy said, what? Ice cream's God too. Well, if it's been offered to Krishna, yes, it is God too. But if you're just eating it for sense gratification, it is. Every bite gets you deeper entangled in material nature. Because when you engage in sense gratification, it's Maya, and God is there, but he disappears from view. He becomes hidden. You can't see him, even taste or touch or smell. When everything is done as a sacrifice for Vishnu, then he appears. That's the difference. So people do this, they engage in their material activities and just say, everything is God, everything is Brahman, I am Brahman, that's Brahman, sense gratification is Brahman, murder is Brahman, whatever. That's their understanding. So Prabhupada is very, it's a gross and stupid understanding of Brahman. It's dull-headed. So Prabhupada is concerned all through how to give us the correct understanding, which is in the Bhagavad Gita, but it's covered. For example, if you go back here to the end of this, he quotes here, talking about Brahman. I'm sorry, not here. We'll get to that. Okay, any other questions so far? Okay. We need to move right along. So we go through, as you can see, as you read these different verses about various things, how this is described. Now we come to text 6, I want to point out, because here again there's a long purport. Although it's a short text, it's only one line, two plus. The Lord's arms are the productive fields for the great demigods, and other leaders of the living entities protect the general mass. Bahara, his two arms, are the loka palana. Loka pala means protector, as Gopal, protector of the cows, and loka means planets. And actually, the Lokapal sometimes are the ten demigods who govern the ten directions are called the Lokapal. Then sometimes Lokapal is the demigods in particular. And Prabhupada also, but loka, the word loka also means population. Like in English we say the whole world knows. When we say the world, we mean all the people in the world. So the same in Sanskrit, loka means the people. And so the protectors of the living entities, leaders of the living entities who protect the general mass. Kshema. Kshema means protecting. Conserving what you have. Maintaining what you have. So then Prabhupada explains this as an important verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, especially because here we're talking about the use of power. Those who are Lokapalas, they have power. And one has to be very careful when one has power, not to abuse it and misuse it. I think one of the huge symptoms of the material world, and especially Kali Yuga, is the abuse of power. Certainly, anytime people get power over others, they think they're God, and they exploit other people, or don't care for them properly. So, the point of this verse is that one who has power of any kind, you may be a small power or a big power. It's just like a mother has power over her children. Sometimes everybody's got somebody. A teacher over the students. Political leaders. Parents. So on. All these people with power. And they are... Everyone who has power, here Prabhupada says, some of them, as particularly mentioned above, are specifically endowed with powers by the will of the Lord. A sane person must know for certain that a living being, however powerful he may be, is neither absolute nor independent. All living beings, so now it's generalized to everybody, all living beings must accept the origin of their specific power. Where did my power come from? Whatever it may be, it comes from the Lord. Near those who are political leaders of various kinds, from the arms unto the Lord. It's the Lord's strength. And I always work with borrowed power. I should not forget this. It's borrowed because we have it, and then it's taken away. Sometimes, like the great philosopher Immanuel Kant, maybe the most brilliant philosopher of his time, when he got old, he could no longer understand his own books. He lost the power. He had it, and then it was taken away. And at the time of death, it's all taken away. As you get old, slowly it's taken away. At different paces. and then finally, ultimately removed. So we do not own it. So Prabhupada's point is that power belonging to Krishna should be used in Krishna's service. And he says later on here, as long as the powerful men of the world do not accept the origin of their respective powers, namely the personality of Godhead, the action of Maya, illusion, will continue to act. The actions of Maya are such that a powerful person misled by the illusory material energy wrongly accepts himself as all in all and does not develop God consciousness. And this leads to the struggle for a hard struggle for existence in human society. The struggle for existence, Prabhupada informs us, is completely unnecessary. What's the matter? What's beeping? Are we okay?
They said we lost your... We lost your
oh, you lost the...
Yeah, there was a power outage for a few seconds.
Okay. Well,
we're out of power. This is battery backup, so we don't have much of
it. So I have to turn this back on again, or...?
We know that now.
Okay, so I'll just read this. He goes on to say, the intelligent class of men, therefore, must admit the Lord as the ultimate source of all energies. And thus pay tribute to the Lord for his good blessings. When somebody has some extraordinary ability, we sometimes say they're gifted. You notice what the word gift means? It means somebody gave it to them.
We also very rarely see that happen.
That people give credit? Yeah.
Right. Very rarely.
Yeah.
The man who has some power or ability.
Yeah, they tend to forget. I once asked Prabhupada, I was really scared when I read the first canto of Bhagavatam for the first time. Because the first Bhagavatams I read was actually the second canto. Because when I came into contact with the devotees in 69, I think in 70 they began, or like in 69, 70, they began to print and publish the second canto. In America there were these thin paperback editions, chapter by, as the chapters were done, and it was, you know, published by ISKCON Press, which was then in Boston. And so that's how I read the second canto first, is my introduction to Krishna consciousness. I mean, I was so fascinated by this universal form. It definitely is the first step of God realization. Came right to me that way. And the first canto, all they had at that time was the three volumes that Prabhupada brought with him from India, and his trunk that he published in India. And those are only available in the temple. So when I moved into the temple, then I could read the first canto, which was the original Indian edition. And when I came to the section about how Maharaj Pritchard received the age of Kali, that's when Prabhupada says, and in the original Indian editions in boldface, he says, no religious principles or ideology can progressively advance without the support of the government. And I nearly had a heart attack. Because, well, two things. One, I realized he's right. Historically, it's true. Christianity did not spread until it had the support of the government. The Roman Constantine converted, really spread. Buddhism didn't spread until Emperor Ashoka took it up. Islam was spread by this, pretty much by the force of arms also. Government means force of arms. Government means, here's a definition of government. This is from the German sociologist Max Weber. That organization which controls the monopoly on legitimized violence. That's what government is.
Yeah, that's what it is.
That's what it is, right, exactly. It's right on. And so what Prabhupada is saying, see, because Maharaj Prickett has the sword, and he's threatening Kali. So, you know, at that time I was always very afraid of those people who was, you know, think they can spread their religion that way. And in America we try to keep this separation, you know. But I saw that, yeah, if the point of human life is God consciousness, and the business of government is to gain the welfare of the people. Their welfare is spiritual advancement, therefore the government should work for their spiritual advancement. It's completely reasonable. But the idea of government force of arms, you know, government power in doing this. And then the second thing, I had already met devotees that scared the hell out of me. They were total fanatics. And I actually had this intuition that if I was ever looking down the barrel of a gun, the guy in the other end would have tilak on. It's turned out to be actually prescient. So then we had this In God We Trust party for purified leaders. And I was one of the people in that party. Balavant and I had a discussion with Srila Prabhupada. Balavant said to Prabhupada, what if we preach and preach and preach and people still do not accept? He's frustrated. He'd been running for mayor of Atlanta. You know, you deal with it. Then Prabhupada, he said, then there should be argumentum ad baculum. Argumentum ad baculum, it means resort to force. Bacula is a stick. So Prabhupada explained, bakula means stick. And then he said, or a gun. And then he went like this, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. This is my second heart attack, you know?
Was he serious?
Huh? He said, there should be a war. He said, these wars that the demons fight the demons, they do not do anything. But if the devotees fight the demons, then it is Krishna consciousness. That's what he said.
Yeah? In the 70s, Kanta also, when there's some description of, somewhere in the commentary, Prabhupada says that we should kill the demons really, like, really clearly.
Yeah, yeah, because, no, this is definitely his philosophy, you know? And I knew it, but now Prabhupada said this, and I thought, you know, I really had a doubt about this whole enterprise. So I wanted to put a question to Prabhupada. And so this is how I put my doubt. I said, you envision a time when devotees will run countries and command armies. Then we become successful. This is what happened. Devotees will run countries and command armies. And Prabhupada said yes. And then because he'd been talking about the war between the devotees and the demons, so I said, then in that case, how can we be sure that we won't become demons? He said, chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regular principles. And I said, and that's enough? And he said, yes, that's enough. Yeah, that's what he said. I was very happy he said something tangible and visible and concrete instead of, you know, always think of Krishna. He said that's what he said. And I accepted it. He was absolutely confident of that. I think, from what I know now, I think you have to, when he says chant 16 rounds, means you chant them in a sustainable way. That is to say, you chant them while trying to give up offenses. Because some people can say they're chanting, or you know, they sit down and do a formal thing while they're committing so many offenses and don't do anything about it. Then that doesn't count. That's nama aparad. there's no potency there. But if one is chanting at least on the clearing platform, yeah. So we cannot. There are people who say that if you're spiritual, you should stay away from power. That means, since the power is floating around to be used, it will be used by the wrong people. Spiritual people, you know, there's that saying in English, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, here, the conditions under which power does not corrupt, is we understand that, well, Krishna's absolute power, it's his power, and what we do, we use in his service. We actually use it in his service, we just don't claim to it, because many people make that claim. And so one has to be, you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect, but one has to be on the path of perfection. That is to say, trying to become free from sins and offenses. And one has to be advancing in Krishna consciousness. To understand that the enemy is sense gratification, because that's corruption. That's taking what belongs to Krishna and using it for our own purposes. That's corruption. Anyway, so Prabhupada says here, he mentions later on in his purport, this is a very nice purport, but he mentions here that the I don't know exactly where it is in the page. I have it marked in my book. The parts and parcels of the Lord are endowed with specific powers for rendering service unto the Lord. That's what those powers are for. They're used for Krishna service, not for our sense gratification. There will be no problem. So here Prabhupada has a whole, in this whole thing, he talks about achieving peace of mind. This is again another peace formula, kind of verse where he's talking about engaging everything in Krishna's service, and therefore the mentality that will once bring peace and prosperity to human society. We have to start at the root of our problems. And this is the root. The root of our problems is the living entities turning away from Krishna. He has an aversion, like perversion, there's aversion. It turns away from Krishna. And that becomes, if one doesn't deal with that, the root of the problem, then you're not be able to deal with anything else. You have to work from inside out. When we try to solve all the problems of human society, just working from the outside in, which is like a Marxist principle, kind of, you know, doesn't do anything. People want to control material nature, but the material nature that we're closest to, our own minds, that we cannot control, that controls us. That we have to learn how to control the mind by Krishna consciousness. So this is, Prabhupada continues with this theme, you see, in text 7, where the forward step of the Lord, the Vikrama, the shelter of the three planetary systems, protection from all fear. He talks about everyone. This is an interesting little point here. Look at this last line. Everyone except the Lord himself is dependent on the mercy of the Lord. Even the all-pervading super soul is also dependent on the supreme absolute bring back in the bottom of the personality of Godhead. So he mentions it's even the super soul. It's dependent upon Bhagavan, huh? Paramatma. In the next verse, where we go to the Lord's genitals.
I actually have a question about that. I have a big question mark underlined next.
Yeah, go ahead.
How is that? That the super soul is dependent on Bhagavan?
Yeah, that's what he says.
In what way?
Huh?
Is there some way to understand it?
What super soul is? I mean, there's no difference between Paramatma and Bhagavan, but nevertheless, the super soul takes on a limited aspect. Because the super soul is the Lord insofar as he is dealing with the material world. So he's only dealing with the material energies. So he's described as an amsha. Eka apshena stito jagat is in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, with one piece of myself, I maintain this whole creation.
So does the super soul worship Bhagavan?
Yeah, of course.
He does.
Yeah, also it goes the other way around. doesn't Krishna Arjuna take a trip and worship Mahavishnu? Mahavishnu is one form of super soul. Yeah, they are worshiping each other all the time. But the main thing is dependent in the sense that a part is dependent on the whole. The hand is a part of my body, but it has its function when it's dependent on the whole. So, Prabhupada calls it a plenary portion. It's a portion, it's a piece, but it's plenary, means it has full power. But nevertheless, everything is not displayed because he's a specialist. The super soul is just dealing with the living entities in the material world and with the material energy. When the Lord is dealing with the spiritual energy, the internal potency, then he's Bhagavan. In Bhagavan, it's the same Lord, but just different kinds of dealing. And in Bhagavan, everything, because they include, they all the aspects are included in Bhagavan. That's my understanding.
So, in the spiritual world, obviously, he's still operating, but he's not a super soul in the way that...
No, the super soul function is there because the Lord is all pervading, everybody has his association. But, you know, nobody has any karma.
Right.
There's no need to control the material energy. I mean, all these things are not there.
So this gets kind of merged in the Mahatma first.
The super soul?
Yeah.
No. You know, if you have, that's another topic. How the Purusha avatars come out. But
in the report number 6, there was a sentence that I thought very incredible, and I was just wondering if you could say something about it. It said, it's in 6,
yeah, here's six
further down in the report.
Yes.
Whatever a person may be in the estimation of the social order of things, if the person tries to reciprocate a feeling of love toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is satisfied with the blessings of the Lord, he will at once feel the highest peace of mind for which he is hankering life after life.
Yeah.
It sounds really fun.
It's great. Yeah, it's a fantastic sentence. There's some sentences that are worth memorizing if you like to memorize. This is one of them. So in other words, if you have a great deal of power still, if you have a relationship with Krishna, reciprocate a feeling of love, which means back and forth, you have a relationship with Krishna, and satisfy with the blessings of the Lord. Whatever he gives me, that I use. It's not mine, I use it in his service, and therefore I can have the power, but I don't possess it, therefore I can act with detachment. Then, your Prabhupada calls this a healthy state of mind. Otherwise you're crazy. Or insane. So this is the definition of mental health. Anything else?
Back to this super soul point.
Yeah.
Would that be correct to say that the super soul's task is to bring a person to the spiritual world where a person would be serving Krishna?
Yeah, in a sense, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's his business. Because he comes as the companion to the soul to bring them back and arranges everything for the restoration of the living entities.
Then he himself not going.
Huh?
Then he's not going together with this, the soul. I mean, like
when a living entity goes back, then the super soul is there as Bhagavan. I mean, everything that the super soul does. It's just that you have a super soul now because you are not conscious of God. When there's no illusory energy, when there's no illusion, then there's no need for the super soul. Even Prabhupada describes later on, we will come to this in our thing, how that for a pure devotee, he doesn't see super soul in the heart. He sees Krishna's pastimes broadcast by a kind of transcendental television in his life. So even a pure devotee in this world actually is no longer dealing with the super soul. That will be mentioned.
So super soul will be separate entity.
Super soul is not separate. Part parcel is his expansion of Krishna. They're none different. They're not different. Now, nothing is different from Krishna, that's true, but we have to understand there are different kinds of differences. Maybe we'll have time to talk about it. We're going to run out of time if we don't get to our... here we come to the genitals of the Lord and so on. The Prajapati's reign, Sarga creation and everything. And then Prabhupada has a purport about the sex. It comes up later in this chapter again. He mentions here that this pleasure, he mentions in the genitals, there's something on there, some substance that gives pleasure, because if you didn't have the pleasure of sex, all the hassles of family life, nobody would put up with it. Of course, we've managed now through modern technology to improve things and just try to get the pleasure without the hassles, which is called sinful, as Prabhupada talks about this. But he says this pleasure-giving substance is not false, however. See, this is when he says not false. This is the Mayavadi thing. Brahma Satyam Jagam Mitya, everything is false. It's real. So it's not false, however, because it originates from the transcendental body of the Lord. In other words, the pleasure-giving substance is a reality, but it has taken on an aspect of pervertedness on account of material contact. As Prabhupada describes in the Bhagavad Gita, that a living entity has prema, love for Krishna, the adi rasa, Prabhupada describes as the transcendental eroticism, is there in Krishna. There's the love for God in the Sringara rasa, it is definitely sex. of some kind or another, not material, but spiritual. Now, of course, you may not have any inkling of that, especially we can't understand it so long as we ourselves are being controlled by sex desire. But it's there in Krishna. But it says when prema comes into contact with the mode of passion, it curdles and becomes manifest as lust. The desire to enjoy the senses, and especially the sexual activity. But by devotional service, this lust is converted back into prema. That's why it's just not suppressed or held down. It is transformed and becomes manifest as love of Krishna, which is also sense gratification that is involved. It's the lust to satisfy Krishna's senses. With the same greediness and avidity and eagerness that I want to satisfy my own senses, when I have that same centeredness on Krishna's sense gratification, then that's Krishna consciousness. Krishna becomes the center of enjoyment. Now, if we go on to text 10, this is an interesting point here, where it talks about the back of the Lord. The word for back is paschima, which also means west. Because in Vedic culture, people are envisioned as facing east. So that right is south, left is north, west is the back. You're always facing east, the rising sun. By the way, so this is the back of the Lord. So there's frustration, ignorance, immorality. That's also part of the universal form. And then Prabhupada deals with this by he's describing here, he then talks about, again, we see the body parts of the Lord are there, therefore he's not impersonal. He's never a formless void. The perfect description of the Lord holds that he's both impersonal and personal simultaneously. The personality of Godhead in his original feature of the Lord is the original feature of the Lord. And his impersonal emanation. So when he talks about the impersonal emanation, it's not in the Brahma Jyoti, but in his material energy. His impersonal emanation is but the reflection of his transcendental body. So by the impersonal emanation, see, there's something about the universal form that is kind of impersonal. Although it's a person, it's not somebody you can relate to on a personal level. That's why Arjuna said, get rid of it. Get rid of it. There's no conception of a relationship. And because it's so overwhelming and awesome and great, those who are fortunate to have a view of the Lord from the front can realize his personal feature, whereas those who are frustrated and thus kept on the ignorant side of the Lord, or in other words, those who have a view of the Lord from the back, realize him in his impersonal feature. This is interesting, because it says that when Moses went up on Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments, he could not see the face of the Lord. He only saw his back. It's in the Bible.
So we know where he was facing.
Huh?
I mean, we know exactly which way he was facing. But Moses was.
Yeah.
He was facing east. Moses was facing east.
Yeah, it must have been. That's right.
In deity worship, and you know, this way is more expert, the Lord is not supposed to face east or west or the cosmic world.
He's supposed to face east.
The Lord is supposed to face east.
Yeah, yeah. When you set a temple up, ideally, the deity should face east. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, yeah, no. Have other. Prabhupada never thought it was, you know, bad. Now, of course, we have our Vastu guys, you know. But anyway, yeah.
Is this verse has anything to do with the, as the farther west you get, the more.
Might be.
Where's the starting point?
Bathing. Nobody knows that.
Which way? No, Vrindavan is west from us. Oh yeah, the Bay of Bengal. Oh, the opposite direction.
Anyway, in text 11 there's an interesting little thing you should know. Avyakta calls in the word for the impersonal feature. Avyakta simply means not manifest. But in the here in the commentary purport, avyakta means the night of Brahma. So here you have I think this often happens. There are multiple readings, and sometimes you'll have one reading in the verse, one another in the word for word, and a third in the purport. Because when you sit with the acharyas, sometimes when they explain the verse, they take all different senses and understand the verse in terms of that. That's how stuff like that happens. And Prabhupada's purport, it's not a contradiction, but just that the words have multiple meanings. So let's see whatever you go to. Okay, now we get on to 13 through 16, there's a whole series of verses here that have a single purport. What this verse talks about gives a list of everything that is there, beginning from Brahma, the demigods, the whole catalog of beings are all covered by the universal form of the Lord at all times. Although he's transcendental to all of them, eternally existing in a form not exceeding 9 inches. That's this, the super soul. But this is, again, so now we started to have a shift to the consideration of the Lord as super soul, is 9 inches. Which we already, so this is a way of review of what was already presented earlier in this canto. So there's the discussion of the 9, although he's so huge, he covers everything, still he's 9 inches. Littler. And then we go on to the description, discussion or indication of Bhagavan, when they start talking about the Chupad Vibhuti. 3/4. Pada means 1/4. And so tripad is 3/4. Or Bhakti Siddhanta likes to call it the tri-quadrantial expansion. Another way of saying 3/4. Yeah.
This verse says here that it names almost everybody in the material universe. And then it says that and everything that be are all covered by the universal form of the Lord at all times, namely past, present, and future. Mm. So when it says and future, does that indicate the idea that we can get liberated from?
No, this is only as long as you're in the material world. When you're liberated, you're not in the future anymore. You're outside of past, present, and future. You just drop out of the whole system.
Okay.
So here Prabhupada mentions, he mentions something which will is really introduced and emphasized in this canto, which is Achincha Beda Beda Tattva. Because of course this culminates in the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam, where it's also one of the verses describes this. So here Prabhupada, in this everything
let me go down here.
Everything rests on the potency of Lord Sri Krishna, and still the Lord is different from the transcendental to all such identities. And so here's the Purusha Sukta confirmed. In the Vedic Purusha Sukta of the Rig Mantra, this is also confirmed. This philosophical truth of simultaneous oneness and difference was propounded by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and is called Achincha Beda Abheda Tattva. Achincha means inconceivable. Beda means different. Abheda. Abheda, not Abheda. Abheda means one, the principle. And to understand, here I want to give you right away the right way to understand Achincha Beda Beda Tattva. It refers very specifically to the difference between the Lord and the Lord's energies. That's the relationship. Prabhupada almost consistently applies it in that way. Unfortunately, in one place, he says something a little different, which is the only place he does it. And you see how here in the Vedabase they put it in red, and you click on it, which says everything is simultaneously one with and different from everything else. But then, when Prabhupada discusses it, it's a difference, one difference between Krishna and Krishna's energies. If you use Achincha Beda Beda Tattva to apply to everything, everything becomes mush. Then all logic, I've seen it used that way. In the early days of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, one of the scientists, way to deal with the relationship between Krishna consciousness, how to resolve the difference between Krishna consciousness and material science, was to say they're inconceivably and simultaneously one and different. Once there was a big ISKCON leader who wanted to be an ISKCON but not under the authority of the GBC, he decided that his organization, his part, and ISKCON would be inconceivably and simultaneously one and different. What you can do anything with it, absolutely anything. So I'd like you to understand this in its strict sense. It's the relationship between Krishna and Krishna's energies. And you even see when they quote it here as everything. Actually, see, when Prabhupada describes it, he's talking about Krishna and Krishna's energies. That's the Achincha. The relationship in Krishna and Balaram is not Achincha Beda Abheda. They're just non-different. Now, there's there's a difference between Krishna and Balaram. But I said they're different. Those are the internal differences within Krishna. They're not between Krishna and Krishna's energies.
Baladeva Devotion brings this up also in relationship to the Lord's internal energy. His Swarup Shakti also is, like Balaram, just non-different. But in discussing it, discussing the relationship between the Lord and his internal potency, the Lord and his body, the Lord and his breath, the Vedas, he gives the analogy, it's like when you say, time always exists, or existence is. And he gives a number of statements like that, kind of somewhat paradoxical statements, but ones that somehow make sense anyway. To say time always exists, because always is just an aspect of time.
Yeah, right.
But so So to say something like the Lord's body, which is the Lord is not different from his body, so to make the relationship between the Lord and his body, or the Lord and his different incarnations or avatars, is he gives an analogy to it. He says it's an appearance of Veda when there really is no Veda.
Well, that's clear enough to everybody. because Krishna's relationship with it, Krishna is not intimate, he's detached from the material creation. That's why when you see Super Soul, he's by himself. Bhagavan, consorts with his internal potency intimately. Lakshmi, Narayan, Sita, Radha, Krishna. Actually, Krishna becomes controlled. Radha Madhava Prabhupada said, Krishna who's controlled by Radharani. See, so actually his internal potency means he is affected by it. The external potency, he's not. Therefore, he never consorts intimately with the external potency. Or Prabhupada said like this, he says, the Lord never consorts intimately with the external potency, but when he does, he's Lord Shiva. He takes on a different aspect of Lord Shiva. Because Shiva is intimately related with Maya Devi, with Durga, not Krishna. So the different, but here's, did I put it up here? I got to put the right button here. There we go. That's okay. Here's a couple of places that I've gotten to illustrate Chincha Beta Beta. The two sentences from Prabhupada. Now, I pulled, here's the last purport in Bhagavad Gita. Although superficially, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the living entity, material nature, and time appear to be different, nothing is different from the Supreme, but the Supreme is always different from everything. So I've sort of turned this into a little koan, you know. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. That's how you understand the Chincha Beta Beta Tattva. You memorize that and you say it to yourself. That because it's the way we see. We should see the Chincha Beta Beta Tattva. Here's another place. This is from the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Leela. Prabhupada concludes, in a sense there's nothing but Sri Krishna, and yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his primeval personality. Another way to say the same thing. There's nothing but Sri Krishna, yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his own primeval personality. This is my suggestion. For keeping in mind what is exactly meant by the Chincha Beta Beta Tattva. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. Okay, so this is where it comes up. Yeah.
Is that Advaita?
It's Dvaita and also Advaita, both. Abeta means Advaita, and Beta means difference, Dvaita. Now, they're one of the schools of Vaishnava Vedanta is called Veda Abeda. But here we have a Naska, what is it called?
Dvaita.
Yeah. But this is particularly a Chincha Veda Veda Tattva. This is our Mahaprabhu's understanding of these things. It's like the key to understanding the relationship of Krishna and his energies. Uh-huh.
Regarding the first phrase, because when we were first discussing it, I was thinking of Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, text 4, which Prabhupada often quotes. Matstani sarvabhutani.
Yeah.
All beings are in me.
But I am not in them, right.
Uh-huh. But I am not there. So it means the energies means that the Krishna, it means the Prakriti and the Jiva are Krishna, but at the same time, they're not Krishna.
Not Krishna, right. Right. Prabhupada said once, like, don't see a tree, see Krishna. Now that doesn't mean the tree is God. But either you know, use the universal form, there are the hairs on his body. And you know, that's bad news for the lumbering industry, because they're giving unauthorized haircuts. Or you see that here's a jiva, he's got a certain karma, he's in this body of a tree. He's a self like me. There's just a really interesting article in the New York Times about a latest scientific advancement about the discovery that animals are selves. They're talking about animal personality. They don't understand the concept of what the self is, but they're now they understand that little beetle with his armor and weird eyes and everything, there's somebody at home there. It's not just a machine, you know. There's a subject, undergoing experiences, and they have character. I just read it before I came in this Sunday Times magazine. We know this. And not only there are brothers and sisters there.
But they're really down there.
Yeah, well, it's okay. I know a lot of people with human bodies that are around there too.
I was hearing recently that a philosopher, a scholar from the Madhva Sampradaya, was writing about how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he considered Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to be an impersonalist, because as long as there was any concept of oneness, then, you know, not the complete duality. So my question is, how...
Yeah, they're really down on Ramanuja too.
My question is, how can if it's not simultaneously one and difference, that the jiva is an ansha of the Lord, part of the Lord, then where does he come from? I mean, how can it be complete duality? How can it... I don't understand.
Me neither. I've never really sat down and studied, a Madhva text that much to understand how they do it.
One of the things that they say that the Lord is the efficient cause of the universe, but not the material cause.
They say
like Brahman, that Brahman is not... We talk about, you know, what's mentioned in the third canto, Pradhan as...
Yeah.
As Brahman.
They say that. He's not the...
They say he's not the material cause.
How do they do that? Anyway.
They accept an internal property.
You see, there's different kinds of causes. According to Aristotle, there's the efficient cause which makes things happen. Like if you take a pot, right? The efficient cause is the potter who makes it. The material cause is the clay. Then they have the formal cause, that the idea of the pot, you know, the abstract conception of what a pot is. And then there's the final cause, what's it for? So we say that the Lord is both the efficient, efficient cause, material cause, formal cause, and final cause. But they actually deny that he's so it's very much like Christianity, actually, in that respect. They also deny that the Lord is the material cause of the world. But what I notice in Christians, they when they try to describe that, where does matter come from? It's just eternally pre-existing matter, and it's not an energy of the Lord. What our acharyas say is it's wound up to the Lord and becomes very subtle, even when the creation is wound up. It's within the body of the Lord, and still it's a little bit different. But it's his energy. Anyway, this is beyond the sphere of my competence. How to deal with the mudwites. I suppose I'll have to do it someday. But I would, knowing what I, from my own experience, I would say when you get into how Mudva explains things, he, without admitting it, has to accept it as an energy of the Lord. But they're afraid of this impersonalism. Madhva is very much against impersonalism. They're so, and they worship everything as God. They worship themselves as God. They worship the universe as God. He wants to put an end to that. So therefore, he emphasizes the difference, the dvaita. That's what he does. So therefore, we, you know, one has to appreciate him. But our understanding is he was, you know, maybe exaggerating a little bit for certain purposes of taking on the
Sankaras.
Yeah. Taking on Shankara. But the Madhvas are very argumentative people. And they also take on the Ramanujas and so on. You know, for his philosophy too. Vishishta Advaita. Oh, Advaita is in there. Ooh. We only have 15 minutes here. But anyway, here's just a Chinchabeda maybe, you know, if you wanna keep this reference just as long as we can. Because it's introduced here, and so, and we'll get into it a good deal more later on. Because now we're now starting to talk about the transcendental position of the Lord. In theology, there's always two terms. One is immanent, the Lord as immanent within the world, and the Lord is transcendent, beyond the world. And some people are just into the immanence and forget the transcendence. Some people emphasize the transcendence more than the immanence, but he's both. He's both like this. And then in the next verse, text 17, the example is given of the sun, how it expands itself through its radiation. And this is the example that Jiva Goswami uses to explain Chinchabeda Veda as the relationship between something and its energies, the sun and the sunshine. On the one hand, we have to distinguish between the sun and the sunshine. When I say the sun is in the room, I don't mean the sun globe is in the room, I mean the sunlight is in the room. But on the other hand, who can tell me where the sun ends and the sunshine begins? So from one point of view, they have to be different. From another point of view, you can treat them as the same, as a single process. Right? And then with text 17, Prabhupada mentions what actually shows up a little later in the verse. This tripad vibhuti and ekapad vibhuti. Vibhuti means opulence or manifestation. Tripad, three-fourths, and one-fourth. This is given 75%, 25%. Now, you know, this gets confusing because it's unlimited. Because If the Lord is unlimited, 25% of infinity is also infinite. There can be larger and smaller infinities according to this mathematics worked out by Georg Cantor of transfinite sets. So that's another thing we don't have to worry about. And in this purport to 17, Prabhupada also mentions the three energies of the Lord. Now, you see how the text is gradually moving toward internal. I mentioned the internal, external potencies. See, because in the text, Bahir and Antar are talked about. Antar, Bahir, internal and external. So Then, text 18, he goes on. The Supreme Personality of God is the controller of immortality and fearlessness. Amrit Pasya, which means deathlessness, and if there's deathlessness, there is also abhaya, fearlessness. He's transcendental to the death and fruitive activities of the material world. Difficult to measure the glories of the Supreme Lord. The Rathaya, you cannot estimate them. Here I want to point out, here's where Prabhupada describes this, the Tripad Vibhuti, the 25% and the 75%. The Pada Vibhuti, one-fourth of the material world, and the mundane. Interesting, nice expression here. Prabhupada says, mundane existence, it's right here, up the mark there. Mundane existence is itself a kind of fear, because in all mundane bodies, the effects of birth, death, old age, and disease always keep a living being compact in fear. So everyone in the material world is afraid. And a lot of times, because it's such an all-pervading fact of our existence, we're not even aware of it. It's like if right now there's background noise. Now, if we speak quietly, listen, we can hear it. But it's so much a part of the, you know, this hum of the electrical current, we're not even aware of it. So we're not aware of this fear until it goes away. So even Western philosophers like Kierkegaard, the theologian, he describes this constant fear. He uses he wrote in Danish, but in English they call it dread. And this constant anxiety that never goes away, even if you're not afraid of any particular thing, or not in anxiety about any particular thing, but still you're full of fear and anxiety. There's a dread, they use the German word angst, because they say in English angst, but angst in German, to indicate this Prabhupada means compact in fear. It's just part of the condition of the material creation. And then, in contrast, in text 19, the contrast is, now we're talking about in the kingdom of God. Beyond the higher planetary systems, there is deathlessness, fearlessness, freedom from anxiety and old age and disease. So now we're being introduced to that transcendent position. And then we find out who can't go there in text 20.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of my favorite words.
The Griha Majors. And Prabhupada treats it as two separate things. Grammatically, it could be the same thing. Because Brihat Vrata means the vow of celibacy, the great vow, the great Vrata. Is the Brihat Vrata. And so Abrihat Vrata can mean those who have not taken that vow, which are Grihavedis, enjoying family life or for the purpose of sex. Or Abrihat Vrata, Prabhupada says, those who have broken the vow, who have taken the vow and broken it. You could take them as one category, or as two categories, as you like. So this is, those people do not get out of the pada traya, these three force energies. And in other words, there's particularly mentioned the enjoying propensity is really center in sexual activity. Sigmund Freud, who's an expert on this business, describes sex as the sexual pleasure as the prototype of all pleasure. Prototype means that against which we measure all others. So you have people in America, at least, they have people that enjoy something a lot, that it was better than sex.
Of course, they're lying, but the trouble with sex, it's so heartbreakingly brief.
So that if one wants to be a transcendentalist, one really wants to get free from bondage of the material world, one has to come to terms with sex desire one way or another. Household or life, okay, gradually. If you follow the principle, actually, if one follows the principles of household or life strictly, as Prabhupada says, then you're considered a brahmachari also. Prabhupada refers to this as the grahastha brahmachari, the householder brahmachari, where sex is only used for the procreation of children and by following garbhadhana samskara, then they're also considered brahmachari. Because you can't be a transcendentalist without following brahmachari one way or the other. So, of course, because the yoga system and personalists, you know, they just demand, you know, householders need not apply. And you tell that to the yoga classes now in America, you know, or the Mayavadis. But if you read what Shankaracharya, his rules, how you have to observe your brahmacharya, you wouldn't believe how tough this is. It's very, very strict, very austere. So all the Mayavadis don't do that anymore. Of course, the yogis, I mean, brahmacharya is one of the yamas or niyamas right in the very beginning, an introductory thing. They skip that, that part, the yamas and the niyamas, and go straight to asana. Consequently, there's no spiritual progress. Because Prabhupada explains in the Bhagavad Gita that since Krishna consciousness is so powerful, there's this allowance made for what he calls the grahastha brahmachari. But if one is married and is having sex for fun, then one understands the difficulties of this man and woman living together and everything. But nevertheless, one pays a price. Because as soon as there's sex enjoyment, then you can identify yourself with the material body. The false ego increases by that. And so you're trying to make spiritual progress, you find yourself in a frustrating position of someone who's trying to light a fire while dousing it with water at the same time. And therefore, spiritual progress will be frustrated. And if Prabhupada talks about this, then he talks about those who have taken celibacy vows and broken them. He mentions Chota Haridas, so on how strict Mahaprabhu was about this. Then finally, we're going to get, it's 6 o'clock. Our destination for the day. This is a very interesting verse. And in this world, by his energies, the all-pervading Godhead is as comprehensively the master of all in the activities of controlling and in devotional service. Shruti is the destination of the living entities, but it's in the dual sense, the dual tense. another Sanskrit guy here pointed this out to me, because Ubayo, both destinations, there's two destinations, right? Or two paths, you could say. Right? One is the path called Sashasana, which Prabhupada says activities of lording it over. What does it mean literally?
Eating.
And anashane, not eating. In other words, eating here stands for sense gratification in general. We can think of eating at McDonald's or whatever. eating and not eating. Enjoying and renunciation. So, he's the Lord of both. Through his energies, he facilitates both. The other name, avidya, and nescience, and vidya, knowledge. He's the master, the ashraya, the shelter of both of them. So, in other words, Prabhupada has explained this. He says that when you want to remember Krishna, Krishna gives you all power to remember him. When you want to forget him, he causes you to forget. So in both cases, Krishna is controlling this. The living entity, somewhere we make a decision. Free decision. Free decision means Krishna is not responsible. We make it. He doesn't do it for us. Once we make a free decision, then Krishna, we do not have the freedom not to be controlled by Krishna. Everything is controlled by Krishna. The extent of our freedom is, how do I want to be controlled? I can be controlled by one of two energies, the external energy, by Maya Devi, or I can be controlled by the internal potency, by Radharani. I have to follow the orders of the Lord. Who are my masters? Are they lust, greed, anger, and so on? Through the external potency? Or is my master the spiritual master? His orders, his directions. When I'm controlled by the order of the spiritual master, even though there may be lust, greed, and anger, you know, just sitting around in my body still, nevertheless, if they don't control my actions, when I'm controlled by the order of the spiritual master, then I'm actually situated in the internal potency. And then gradually all that other stuff floating around will go away. But if that controls me, then I'm controlled by the external potency. But the choice, which one? That's actually my choice. How it's facilitated, that is what the Lord does. So that when we surrender to Krishna, the material energy which acted to bind us changes and starts to act to free us. The way it acts with reference to a devotee is different from the way it acts in reference to a materialist. Okay. I should stop there. Do we have time for questions?
The sasana anasana means eating and not eating, both.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But here Prabhupada is saying that asana activities of leading over,
yeah,
and anasana activities of devotional side.
Yeah.
How do you adjust it?
Well, I adjust it because Prabhupada just says, and when you look at what the commentators say, Prabhupada has other people giving purport. Maybe you have some commentary there, I don't know. But in the context of the verse, the word eating is just used to indicate material enjoyment. And in the context of this verse, not eating means refraining from material enjoyment.
And how do we refrain from our material enjoyment? By engaging in devotional service, what Prabhupada calls it, devotional service.
One who is accepting to shravan, not the material enjoyment, he's also eating,
isn't it? Yeah, that's true. That's true, but we don't eat prasadam.
We honor.
No, we honor. It's not eating. It's honoring prasadam. We always try to say that, huh? We honor prasadam. We don't use that word eat with reference to prasadam. Yeah?
It is a Chittavaya and Veda Tattva idea. Are we everything simultaneously one with and different from the Lord? So are we as marginal energy? Are we one with and different from the Lord in a different way than matter is?
Yeah. Uh-huh. There are different kinds of differences. We're qualitatively the same and quantitatively different. Which, by the way, that particular thing, I have to say, is not really a chinchev. If something is the same in one respect and different in another respect, it's quite conceivable. But anyway, but matter is not qualitatively one with the Lord, at least as it appears to us now. You know, the wonderful thing about Krishna consciousness is that you don't have to be God, you don't have to be omniscient. You know, I once said to Prabhupada, I walked with him, and I asked him a question. I said that the Krishna is all powerful and he can do everything by himself. Why does he need all these demigods to control the material world? The Prabhupada stopped and he looked at me and he said, "You don't know how to run the universe." And I thought, that's true. So we don't have to, we can clear things up as much as possible. But in inquiring to things that are achincha, we should understand that
it's achincha.
It's achincha, right. Which means that one can have realized knowledge of these things, practical love, but it is hard to understand or to explain with words and terms from this material world. But there are different kinds of differences. There's the difference that something has within himself, internal differences, a difference that an entity has with things like himself, and differences he has things unlike himself. And so, you know, you have to understand that in some ways this applies to here. But if we say ultimately everything is spiritual, you know, then there are different kinds of spirit. That was another thing, another conversation I had with Prabhupada. We were walking in New Vrindavan to the woods, and Prabhupada started talking about how everything is spirit. There is no matter. And he used the example, he pointed to the trees, said, just like this wood, it's just fire in another form. So we call it wood, it looks like wood, but actually it's simply another form of fire. So actually, what we call matter is just spirit. He said, you take the wood, and when you ignite it, the fire comes, the sunlight comes in there, and then when you ignite it, the fire comes back out again, right? So it's just fire. So I was, at this time, a really new devotee, and my biggest effort was to understand the difference between matter and spirit, as am I not my body. And then Prabhupada sitting around saying that everything is spirit. So I asked Prabhupada, I told him this, you know, how am I supposed to, I'm trying to understand the difference between myself as a spirit soul and the material body, the difference between that. Now you say everything is spirit. And he said to me, we are not Maya bodies. He said, there are different kinds of spirit. That's what he said. Yeah.
One thing the Divya is coming, that you know the God, Paramatma, Atma, body, and subtle body, but the heart is super soul matching inside. What does it, how it works?
How the super soul works?
Yes. I mean, soul is there, and then Paramatma is there.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So how the super soul acts?
How does he act, or what does he? The super soul, as I understand it, the super soul understands the desires of the living entity. We turn the job so we're not distracted anymore by the Lord. Super soul understands the desire of the living entity. And the super soul is the one that makes this body work. This is the material energy. I don't control the material energy. Krishna controls the material energy. So Krishna runs this body. I don't run the body. That's why the body is a chariot. And am I the driver? No, I'm the passenger. I just sit there. Krishna holds the reins. So he runs the body. For the sake of this particular living entity. I don't know anything. You know, I want to raise my hand and my hand goes up. I can't tell you how I did that. I have no idea. All I know is I want to raise my hand and it goes up. I can't tell you I raised it in a sense because it just happens. Who raised my arm? The Krishna, right. So somehow he does it. How he controls me, I don't have any idea. I said, I don't have to be God. All I have to do is be a devotee. But I don't have to understand everything about it. We can know Krishna as Prabhupada said, to some extent. Yeah.
You're indicating that the difference between Krishna, the Lord, and the living entities is not inconceivable. So what is
no, in the sense that what's conceivable is that we're qualitatively the same and quantitatively distinct. Because if you're different in different aspects, one's quality, one's quantity, then we can understand that perfectly well. Even though Prabhupada does use this to talk about oneness and simultaneous oneness and difference, strictly speaking, it's not inconceivable. Other aspects are inconceivable. Of the relationship between the living entity and Krishna. Other aspects are inconceivable. Yeah.
I just thought that the devotional also points out inconceivable, literally the Sanskrit word means that you can't speculate your way to it. So even if it's understandable when you've learned it through Shastra, it's not a conclusion that you would ever arrive at.
By speculation. That's a nice point. Mm-hmm. That's why you have to have, you know, we have to have Jnana Chakshusha. Yeah, it's special. It's revelation, or it's inspiration. That's how we ultimately know anything. We get inspired by Krishna as the super soul. What does that inspire me? The Dhammi Buddhi Yoga Tata. Yes. That's where it comes from.
I suppose I want to avoid this question, but this verse here about the others who do not strictly follow celibate vows must live within the three material worlds.
Yeah.
How long do you have before you strictly follow celibacy vows?
Depends. If you want to be happy for the rest of your life, make an ugly woman your wife. I know. I mean, it depends, you know.
Because I mean, if we go by this verse, you know, there's so many people in the Krishna consciousness who have not strictly followed celibacy.
Yeah, well, then they have to take birth again. Hopefully, there's some improvement. Next birth, you say, I got to get married, but you know, the beautiful wife is the enemy at home, right? Anyway, it is one way or another a gradual process. What is required for us is to be committed to it. I mean, I think most people, the problem is they just don't make up their minds. Because the destruction of our desires to enjoy in the world is Krishna who destroys them. Specifically, Prabhupada tells us that we should pray to Lord Nisringadev. Every day we should pray by hearing Nisringa, Hridaye Nisringa. Hridaye Nisringa means that we are saying to Lord Nisringadev, please manifest in my heart and destroy my Hiranyakashipu-like desires to enjoy in this world. So our material desires are karmashaya, the longing to for fruit of work, like Kamashian, is like Hiranyakashipu. That is to say, bigger and stronger than we are. We can destroy it. But if the Nisringadev appears in our hearts, he can do it, right? So we have to pray, please destroy it. Then it can be done. Well, most of us say Hridaye Nisringa, we don't even know what we're saying. But you have to ask him to come. You may say, well, I'm asking him, he doesn't come. Look and see what we're at, how badly do we want to come. What was our real thing is, please destroy my material desires, but not now. A little later on. Give me another 10 years. Or something like that. Or destroy my material desires, but not this one. Then it won't come. So one has to really understand the path of Krishna consciousness and accept it. So it's our condition that we have material desires. But our attitude toward our own desires is the first thing that has to change. We have to target them for destruction. I saw, you know, when they had the first Iraq war on television, you know, the way they do it is that there'd be a guy on the ground and you have this little thing and it makes a little laser point on the target, right? Hits it with a little red dot laser. And then comes this cruise missile, wham! Right? So what we have to do is put that laser point on our material desires. And then put a shrinking tape, kind of like a cruise missile, blows the thing up, you know. So we have to target them for destruction. Mm-hmm. That's what you require. Yeah.
I believe you made a statement right before you started answering the questions that at the end of the day, and I'm paraphrasing, at the end of the day, the devotees are dealt with differently than the materialists. You said there is a difference in how they're dealt with. So my question is, if Prabhupada said that that we are the most difficult thing for, the only problem that we're actually facing is surrendering to Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So in relationship to Gita Narayana's question, as we're aspiring to surrender to Krishna, then what is it, how are the devotees dealt with differently? What is it that makes the devotees dealt with differently? I mean, do devotees, just because we are entering in this process?
Yeah, just to be interested in surrendering to Krishna. Because when Krishna sees just the slightest hint that you're interested, in spite of so many things, I'm interested in certain Krishna, I have other interests too, you know, but at least it's there. And Krishna jumps on it. Because he's just so happy. When somebody, some soul has been turned away for so long, starts to turn back. When we first start to turn back, I'm not even sure we're conscious of it. My intuition, or maybe I'd say my speculation, is any person who's not a devotee even, but he has a moral choice, and there's a good and a bad, and he chooses good, that's the beginning of a little time. That's why, you build up with those good choices, you get a habit, and, you know, that's punya karma. And then, you know, that gradually will take you to Krishna. I don't know how it happens. Somehow, deep, you know, we finally decide, you know, we want to turn back toward Krishna.
We may not even be aware of it consciously, but the super soul is aware of it. And then he begins to facilitate our coming back to him. Somehow or other, that happens. And even if we're not complete, it keeps on going. Even if we fall away, Prabhupada has said that we do not undergo the ordinary course of karma. So we fall away from Krishna, we will suffer. But at least we'll suffer to some purpose. We won't just suffer like cats and dogs. That's my understanding. So even if we fall under the material energy again, it doesn't quite work the same way. With reference to the devotees, even fallen devotees, as it does towards just hard materialists. Because really, you know, once you've had just even the littlest taste of Krishna consciousness, you can't forget it. Even though you try. I see people try very hard sometimes and it won't go away. They even hire mental health workers to try to help them get rid of it. Still won't go away. Yeah?
You know, this the sequence of right choices, I'm thinking, maybe it's...
Sequence of?
Right choices.
Oh, yeah, I mentioned,
it. Is it the result, maybe, of Ajnana Sukriti?
Yeah, well, that's on top of it. The idea about pious activities, which is especially good about just material piety, is you may get a chance, more of a chance to do Ajnana Sukriti. Say you're a nice guy and you're driving along the highway and somebody is broken down on the side and you see they need help and you have this habit of stopping to help people. So then it's more likely that if a devotee is broken down on the side, you'll help that devotee and therefore Agyanta Sukriti. Agyanta Sukriti means unknown devotional service. You do some service. Or you just like devotees. You don't know why you like devotees, but you just want to do something to help them. You don't. Maybe you don't even know they're devotees, but something. You know, that becomes. That increases the chance. But that, I guess, is pretty special. Yeah.
Just thinking, if the person is completely, you know, miscreant. For example, he's stolen a book. It's not the right activity, but then. He just gave his book to his friend to read.
Uh-huh.
So would it be considered as a guest?
I don't know why not, yeah, maybe.
So even if he's useful, he can?
Yeah. Could be.
Is it?
Huh?
There's a story about
it. Is there?
Yeah. About the body who swept the steps of the Shrimadeva temple.
Uh-huh.
Enjoy with a woman, play down the door, but it was an old Shrimadeva temple.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a story from the chapter.
Because uh-huh. He got to be a temple, right?
Yeah, because he swept the temple, he became a great devotee.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to, since morning this morning about the temple, I about Vidayam Shrimadeva again, repeated it. It seems also it sounded like you even had personal kind of like realization of that. You know, the power of Lord Nrisingadev. And my question is that, and even here in Mayapur, worship of Lord Nrisingadev has kind of developed into quite a big part of the sadhana and the worship. And it seems, and we've seen how powerful it is, and my question is, Prabhupada kind of introduced that, like later, and particularly when he was sick, like chanting the machine prayers.
Yeah.
So why wasn't it? I mean, we're building the kind of emphasis on it, and I just wonder if you have any comment on that.
Well, yeah, with Prabhupada, he just introduced the Nrisinga prayers. When he was sick, and for protection of the movement. And a lot of times we thought it was Nrisingadev who would save us from the demons outside, and we forgot the demons inside. But what I'm telling you is from in the fifth canto, where the different residents of Jambudvipa offer prayers,
Prahlad Maharaj leads the residents of Hari Varsha in prayers to Nrisimhadev. And that's where he has the Upanishadic mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Narasimha, Tejas Tejas, Adir Adir Bhava. And so there you're praying to Nrisimhadev, Karma Shayan Randaya Randaya. And Prabhupada calls Karma Shayan our demonic desire to enjoy in this world. It's also the Hridaya Granthi, the knot in the heart. And so in the purport to that, he talks about we have to become desirous if we want to go back to Godhead. And then the purport to the next verse, that's where he says this, we should pray by hearing the Sringa, Hridaya Sringa, and we should ask the Sringa to appear in our hearts and destroy our demonic propensities to enjoy in the world. The next verse is Prahlad Maharaj's Swastiastu Vishvasha Kala Pasidatam Dayam Tukutani Shivam Mito Udiya Manastabhadram Bachatadaroktaje Aresatam Nova Matirapiraituki. May the whole universe become auspicious, filled with peace and happiness. Kala Pasidatam, may all those who are envious and nimuk hostile become pacified, reconciled. May all living entities learn to wish each other well. May they have this mentality of wishing each other well. And then manastabhadram, and may our own minds, he gets now goes from everything to heaven, may our own mind become bhadram. How will all that happen? By becoming fixed in consciousness in devotional service to the Lord, causeless devotional service to the Lord. So actually, there's a Prabhupada says there, he remarks, quoting Vishwanath Chakravarti, what he calls a very fine purport, that Vishwanath Chakravarti says, whenever there's a prayer, there's a request for a benediction. Sometimes we mistakenly think you shouldn't ask Krishna for anything, but he says, whatever there's prayer, there's request for benediction. He said, even pure devotees ask for things. And then he quotes, Ayi nanda tadu ja kinkuram patitam mantishamayalam. He's asking. Bhavatat bhakti raitati. We ask. But the heart meaning of the Hare Krishna mantra, please engage me in your service. And the corollary was obviously disengage me from anything else. One has to pray. And one has to pray with some feeling. Even if it's just get me out of this place. we have a desire for devotional service. We should be aware of the obstacles. And we should be praying to the Lord. Puri Chanda Hare Krishna Mantra, praying that constantly. Please engage me in your service. That obviously means, it's a logical corollary, it's the same way of saying the same thing. Then please disengage me for anything that gets in the way. My material desires, my sins, my offenses, all those things. Clear them out. We should. Prabhupada remarked that he said that the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra should be like a child crying for his mother. So when we chant the Hare Krishna mantra, we should chant with feelings. If we just first of all, there needs to be attention. We just pay attention to the Lord. I mean, within attention lie the seeds of love. When you love something, you certainly pay attention. Something or someone, you pay attention. But the converse is also true. If you pay attention, you become interesting. At least. Huh? Anything in this material world, if you pay enough attention to it, becomes interesting. There are people who have, somehow they can pay attention. Somebody pays attention to rocks. They spend their whole life fascinated with rocks. They're geologists. You know, they're obsessed with rocks because they're really interesting. Simply because they can pay attention. That's because Krishna is so interesting. Everything in relation to Krishna is.
There's a problem intellectuals have, you know, that you can't get distracted by interesting things in the material. But if you focus on Krishna, so you give Krishna your attention. And especially once we start paying attention to Krishna, even by force, the mind goes away, you bring it back. When chanting Hare Krishna, the mind goes away, you bring it back. The mind goes away, you bring it back. If we want to clear our offenses, Bhaktivinoda Thakur tells us that you have to first of all deal with this pramadaha, inattentiveness. Then you can deal with the other ones. And then so we just showed Krishna the courtesy, the etiquette of giving him some attention when we're inviting him to come into our hearts. We pay him some attention. Then he pays attention to us. And then just from attention, feelings will develop. What feelings are may be very surprising, but anyway, the real feelings in relationship to Krishna will develop. That much I know. From experience, yeah. Okay, we're gone a half an hour late. I'm sorry about that. So the next tomorrow, the next half of this chapter.